This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Bombs are once again raining down on Darfur, Sudan, and Arab militias, known as Janjaweed, are again raiding and burning villages. It's a return to the style of attacks that began the violence in Darfur more than 5 years ago. The only thing protecting civilians caught between government forces and countless rebel factions is an exhausted and ill-equipped group of African Union peacekeepers. That may change soon, though perhaps not soon enough. Last summer, the United Nations gave the go-ahead to a new joint peacekeeping force that would triple the number of troops in Darfur. But the government of Sudan has actively tried to slow and even block its deployment. Michael Gawet is the leader of the UN team responsible for those peacekeepers. He says they're moving as fast as they can, but there's another obstacle in his way, Darfur itself.
I was just there, and you go to these broad patches of scrub and desert, and you know that in a matter of months, we're going to have all the accommodation for thousands of troops in place. It's a very difficult thing to do in a spot that is more or less smack in the middle of Africa with minimal infrastructure.
Has the government of Sudan been insisting that all of the troops be from African countries as opposed to predominantly from African countries, which was the agreement?
Well, their position is the one that was expressed in the Security Council resolution, which is that the force has to be predominantly African. They have gone public to say that all efforts should be made to deploy African troops first, and then non-Africans will be considered. And we're doing our best to work with that. And in fact, the next set of troops that are in the pipeline, the major injection will come from Egypt and Ethiopia. So we hope and expect that will go some way to addressing the government's concerns.
And after that, if there were troops coming from another country, say Thailand, would the government of Sudan let them in?
They've told us that if the Africans are deployed first, then there shouldn't be any problem.
And you believe them?
The proof of the pudding, Melissa, will be in the tasting.
Once these troops get to Darfur, if they get to Darfur, what is their mandate? What are they allowed to do?
You know, it's interesting, and it doesn't get discussed much, but the mandate of this joint African Union-United Nations operation is tremendously expansive. We've been tasked to look into the human rights situation. We've been tasked to help with building systems for the rule of law. We've been tasked to help in an area they call child protection. But the marquee issue in the mandate is quote-unquote protection of civilians.
Does that mean that if there were to be an attack by, say, Sudanese army troops, Janjaweed militia against civilians, that the UN troops are authorized to use deadly force to stop that attack?
There's one thing we have to clarify, that a peacekeeping operation is just that. It is deployed and it is equipped and capable of operating in an environment where two sides have agreed to a peace. It's not deployed to enforce a peace. And I think if there's one piece of red-hot bad news coming out of Darfur right now, it's that the war is back on in the West. And the government is taking it to rebels that and these are rebels that have openly said they want to unseat the government, so there's a conflict there. And our concern, of course, is that there are civilians who are suffering in the mix.
What did you see on this last trip to Darfur that made you so concerned about what's going on right now?
You know, we traveled out to the west, to El Geneina, and it was right in the middle of a major government offensive. They were attacking rebel-held positions. And so while we were there, reports were coming in of villages being burned and people being displaced. That's of enormous concern for all sorts of reasons. The first and foremost is the human suffering one. And it's our obligation to do everything we can to stop the suffering. The second concern is that there may be this expectation that the force as it is would be able to somehow magically step between two warring parties and stop a war. We're not equipped to do so. So in this case, it means going to the highest level of the Sudanese government and imploring them to stop. It means going public and making sure that those who are in a position to decide to launch these attacks know that we're watching what happens to civilians.
How confident are you that there is the international will to send the troops that are needed, the numbers of troops that are needed to Darfur?
You know, when we solicited for these troops, there were a lot of offers. But if you scratch down a layer or two, we have a few problems we have to solve, one of which is that some of these countries that have volunteered troops will require some help in equipping them and training the troops on the equipment and then making sure that once they're out in Darfur, they'll be able to sustain themselves. This process is not an overnight process, and we're in a situation where we need an overnight process. So there's still a bit of a disconnect in terms of what will be required to get these troops ready and how fast we need them.
What else do you need besides troops on the ground?
Well, we need a few simple mechanical things. We still haven't received offers of the attack helicopters that we see as a fundamental requirement for this force to be effective. Darfur is huge. Everybody knows the tagline. It's the size of France. There are no roads and so on and so forth. So if you have a flashpoint hundreds of kilometers away and the force commander needs to get there or send people there, you can only do it through air. Likewise, you need military aviation that just moves troops, and we're short 18 transport helicopters on the military side. We also need what they call a medium transport unit, which is basically an assemblage of military trucks that can likewise move into difficult areas. So there's some basic requirements for this force that we haven't received. And, our knuckles are bloody from banging on doors.
Just to be clear, what would those attack helicopters be authorized to do under the UN mandate?
Move troops and protect civilians, as per the resolution.
Protect civilians, meaning they can fire on troops attacking them?
If you read the resolution, there is a line in there that makes it clear that if civilians are under duress, that the mission can take appropriate action to defend them. As I said, the headline of this mission is to end the suffering, and that means that when you see a civilian in trouble, you do something to help them out.
Mr. Gawa, you've been going to Darfur many, many times over the last 3 years. Have you seen any signs that things are better now for the people in Darfur than they were when you first went?
I think you asked me the question at a bad moment. These are dark days in West Darfur. From the perspective of the peacekeeping operation, there's some good news, as I said, because we've injected some senior leadership, we've injected some systems. And there is a kind of inexorability to the deployment. It doesn't happen as fast as we want, but it does happen. Once the oil tanker has the coordinates punched in, it pushes off the dock and heads for the high seas. The issue is it's not happening fast enough. And the other issue, of course, is that even fully deployed, it will not solve the problem. It's politics that will solve the problem.
Michael Gawat, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Melissa.
Michael Gawat is the leader of the UN team responsible for managing the United Nations African Union peacekeeping operation in Darfur.